Good afternoon. I'm David Borax of WFAE.
And I'm Jeff Tiberi of WUNC. This is special coverage of the 2018 election.
Today and tomorrow, we're looking at issues and races from across the state.
Like the proposed constitutional amendments. Confused? You're not alone.
Unfortunately, I'm not read up on all of them. I'm familiar with just like a couple with just basic wording.
We'll sort through that wording.
And we'll sort through legislative races that will determine how much power Republicans will have in the General Assembly and the national politics at play in local races. No matter your politics, we know feelings are strong.
Is this the most important midterm election of our lifetime?
Yes.
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 Absolutely yes.
Welcome to our listeners across North Carolina. We're glad you've joined us for 2 hours of conversation today and tomorrow about a fascinating midterm election.
You're going to hear from candidates, political scientists, voters, and reporters about what's on the ballot, from these congressional and legislative races down to those six proposals to amend our state constitution.
But first, let's take a listen back at how we got here. In 2010, Republicans took control of the legislature for the first time since Reconstruction. The shift in power led to unprecedented redistricting, major tax reform, and a series of culture wars. First, we begin with a reflection from that historic takeover.
As for 2010, the Tea Party was arriving. Support for Obama, indeed the nation's first black president, was diminishing. And Democratic control in Raleigh, amidst a national economic collapse, was sputtering.
And I think 10 was a good year because so many people were just, pardon my French, pissed off. And, you know, we took advantage of that. I think it worked in our advantage. It's always easy to win an election with a wind behind you. And it seemed like, up until that point, the wind had always been in our faces. I think it was just a seismic switch in politics in North Carolina.
The right turn began at fundraisers and Rotary clubs. It became more official on a Tuesday. Many of the leading characters gathered at the Marriott in downtown Raleigh, including Tom Fetzer, the state Republican chairman.
All of you are going to remember that you were in this room on November 2nd, 2010, because this is the night the Republican Party made history.
There's got to be a moment when you thought, holy, we did it. We pulled this off.
I was with staff behind closed doors, and I got a phone call from Mark Basnight acknowledging that we had taken the majority and telling me that he was ready to help us with anything we need on the transition.
Did you laugh? Did you cry? Did you hug everybody? What was the reaction? That's a big moment in the state's history.
Yeah, it was. I'm not a big hugger. I'm not a big laugher or crier.
It was a lot of high-fiving, a lot of happiness. You know, Republicans don't hoot and holler too well. Not like the Dems do, but no, it was a joyous night. Everybody was upbeat and happy. It was a great night. And
But there was a strong sense of gratitude, a sense that a lot of hard work by not just me, but by a lot of other folks had provided us with that moment. But then sort of a somber moment thinking of, okay, so now what do we do?
And a lot of us were in shock. A lot of us, we were just kind of dumbfounded and, you know, now what do we do? We have caught the bus. What are we going to do?
But tonight's also a night for us to remember that this is just the beginning of a lot of things that we've got to do. Our state is headed on the wrong path. The voters know that our state has been headed on the wrong path. They have asked us to right that path.
Republicans had taken back not only the Senate, but also the North Carolina House. They had done it methodically, bludgeoning Democratic incumbents and snatching power of both chambers for the first time in 142 years. Often overlooked with everything that has transpired since is the fact that Republicans defeated the opposition that night in districts which the Democrats had themselves drawn.
Those were the voices of Phil Berger, Tom Apodaca, and Tom Fetzer, Republican leaders reflecting on election night 8 years ago. The clip is from this week's WUNC Politics podcast, an hour-long look back at the last decade in politics here in North Carolina. You can hear more wherever you get your on-demand listening. Now let's take a look at some of that history.
Joining us on the line from Greenville is Tom Eamon, a professor of political science at East Carolina University, a longtime observer of the fascinating North Carolina politics. Thank you for joining us, Professor. How are you?
I'm delighted to be with you and with such distinguished analysts also.
Well, it's great to have you here. Since the GOP orchestrated that takeover back in 2010, we've certainly seen a significant shift to the right in terms of conservative policy. What followed was, in many ways, the counterpunch from the left in the form of court challenges and these protests. All this came at a time when the population of North Carolina really surged, and the state, in many ways, has emerged as a more relevant player on the national political scene. A loaded question to start, but how do you summarize this stretch of Republican rule?
All right. Well, let's have a little perspective here, and I agree with you that that was a very dramatic time, marked a major change in state politics. But just to flash back a little bit, an equally good time for the Republicans came in 1972, but it was on the statewide level. But that's the year that Jesse Helms won the Senate seat by a big margin and would stay for 30 years, and that Jim Holzhauser was elected governor also. But to tie this into the legislature and to show you how much things have changed since then, the legislature at that time, after that dramatic Republican victory, still remained with in the Senate 35 Democrats, 15 Republicans, and in the House, 85 Democrats and 35 Republicans. So it's a testimonial to how much we've changed since then that we had such dramatically different results just a few years ago, the ones that you have just highlighted, where there was a major sweep. But it's important to note that the legislative change really trailed the change on the statewide level by quite a few decades.
Well, Tom, did we see this coming? Were there any inklings in advance of that election that there was this Republican wave coming?
Well, we saw that there was likely to be a dramatic change. Yes, indeed, we did. But still, there had been a few times, like after Bill Clinton's first 2 years in office, there were substantial Republican gains in the General Assembly. But then we went back where the normal pattern was for the Democrats to prevail. And so this was surely a dramatic time. And indeed, the last few years have been among the most dramatic of all, with Barack Obama doing rather well, I would say very well, considering the state's political history in carrying the state by around 14,000 votes. But then we began to see a change. But a way that this did follow a pattern, typically after the first 2 years of a presidential term, the end party is going to suffer. And so in that particular sense, the elections of 2010 were following a pattern that we've seen for a long time. But most definitely, if you look at the state and you analyze voting trends according to region and urban-rural, I think we could see this something like this coming, but not quite what we did see. We could see a wave, but it turned out to be a tsunami.
Sure. And it's interesting talking with a lot of the strategists and political folks in Raleigh. Many have told me that had Republicans run a candidate in every Senate district back in 1994, they probably would have taken both chambers then, but they really weren't anticipating as much of a blue wave as transpired nationally back in 1994. Professor, I'm interested in the why. The state was, if memory serves, Barack Obama's most narrow victory in 2008. It was the closest defeat that he received in 2012, his reelection bid. And the state has really become much more of a hot button area at times for a divisive cultural politics. We've seen major tax reform here, something that the Republicans say they don't get enough credit for. Well, why did it all come about in the last decade or so?
Well, let me mention, at this point, there's definitely a cleavage in the state. The state's always had a lot of cleavages, but particularly then. And Barack Obama did especially well in the urban areas of the state. In fact, if you just take the five largest counties in the state, he won by 297,000 votes in those counties. And compare that to a state margin, just 14,000. But to show the divide, or to lead up to it, let me mention that in 2016, in the five counties that I was just noting, that Hillary Clinton won by 410,000 votes. and still she lost the state. And what has happened in a lot of the small town and rural areas, smaller cities, the outer fringes, and I stress the outer fringes of metropolitan areas, and perhaps most of all in the area of small towns, formerly textile territory, really running across the Piedmont, generally working class areas, areas where people feel unhappy, left out, a tremendous number of people have gravitated toward the Republican Party in recent years, and that has been a major part of it. And that area, the Republican spine or backbone, as I call it, of North Carolina, is the area that has really prevailed in recent elections. So most definitely a cultural split with the larger cities and their immediate surrounding areas going one way, but a lot of the rest of the state going the other way.
You're talking about that rural-urban divide, which we've heard so much about
rural,
since the—
Rural-urban, or I would also say small town, places like, Kannapolis and that whole belt that was such great textile territory at one time. And so it's not quite as simple as just rural-urban, but I would say rural and small town versus the larger urban areas that are really following a pattern more like urban areas in, say, the Northeast and West would follow, but the smaller towns, a lot of the rural areas, are really moving in the other direction. So I think we can't underestimate the importance of this divide, much of which I think is cultural.
And we're seeing a big surge of early voting here. I think some of that from the rural areas. Can you say a little something about that?
Initially, it seemed to me that the Republicans were probably prevailing a bit better than would have been expected. The most recent results I've seen would suggest that the Democrats are also quite mobilized. But I do think in the heavy vote, the heavy early vote that we're seeing, this cleavage is of great importance, and that both groups are really turning out at a somewhat heavier level than would be expected, up to this point anyway.
Tom Eamon, professor at East Carolina University, is joining us here as we chat about these midterms. We're getting into the midterms, we swear, but trying to provide a little bit of a historical perspective here. So Republicans took back the legislature in 2010. In 2012, they further strengthened their majorities after redistricting in the form of supermajorities or veto-proof majorities. And one of the bigger picture, or the big picture legislative item that is really in play this midterm is whether or not the Republicans can again defend these supermajorities. Civics here. Why is that so important? And if the Democrats can crack one or both of those, what does that mean?
All right. And the goal for the Democrats is to win enough seats so that there is no longer the supermajority. And then the governor's vetoes would they'd be turned around, or he would be able to turn around the situation. He could block a whole lot that is there. Now, so of vital importance. Now, my own opinion is that if there is a Democratic wave, if there's a blue wave, that the Democrats have a good chance in the House of Representatives of breaking that supermajority. In the Senate, as I see it, looking at district after district, it's going to be more difficult to do. And if that were done, I would say the Democrats could complain. Would certainly have had won a substantial victory. As for taking over the House or the Senate, it is inconceivable, with the districts drawn the way they are now, that the Democrats could actually take over. In fact, I told my students that if that happened, that I would be willing to stand up before them and drink a bottle of turpentine.
Wow! So you,
I am on that particular point. It would be more than a tsunami if that were to happen. But I would say it's a mild Democratic victory if they can get enough votes in the House so that the supermajority would not be there. And I would say it would be close to a tsunami if they could do that in the Senate also. But that's the best they can hope for.
So if it's a minor victory to end a supermajority and worth drinking turpentine if they can take back one of the majorities, well, what's the in-between? What's a significant victory or a very good night for the left?
Okay, I would say a significant victory would be to win enough seats in the House so there would no longer be the supermajority that we're talking about. I would say a major victory would be to do that also in the Senate, where I see it being a bit more difficult. And again, I say this as one who thinks that North Carolina is a purple state. It's very closely divided, but just given the way the districts are drawn, at the moment, it would be very difficult to do any more than what I have outlined. I should, in fairness, say the Democrats certainly gerrymandered a lot, too, but the difference is that the software for doing that had improved a lot by the time the Republicans were able to do it in 2011. And so that's why the state is evenly divided, but the Democratic prospects in the House and Senate are uphill, and they can certainly make gains that they can boast about, but that's about the most that can be done. Though as a practical matter, if the governor's vetoes can stand, that's certainly significant for the Democrats.
Well, Tom, we're taking sort of a big picture look at it here, but these elections are voted on a district-by-district basis. Voters are making decisions based on local races. And back in 2010, were there issues that people were voting on, and are any of those the same now?
I think that some of the same places, you know, you have almost a repeat in some cases of the candidates, the issues. I do think something that comes in, however, here is that when it comes to these local races, that you aren't just getting the national issues. I think a lot of people are going to be voting in these area races, the district races, according to whether they like a particular individual or not. I think we often, as political scientists and people in the media, we make the mistake of attributing whatever might happen to, let's say, Trump in this case. And I do think that the local factors are going to figure in here. And so that could also have an impact on the particular results and reflects a lot more than just the presidential race or the presidential popularity or unpopularity of the president.
Tom Eamon from East Carolina University. Just a final moment here before we need to step aside for just a minute. As you look at this in the final 5 days or so, what's one thing you're keeping an eye on? And do you think that either of the supermajorities will be broken at the North Carolina legislature?
Okay. We have a lot to keep an eye on, but we're focusing largely on the legislature. I think there is a pretty fair chance, let's say 50-50, that will be done in the House. But, you know, I am, you can tell I'm very cautious about
sure.
that. I would be much more surprised in the case of the Senate. But I've always joked with friends that I have a whole lot more fun talking about elections after they are over and analyzing them than I do when I'm trying to predict, because you can be proved wrong in just a few days.
Tom Eamon of East Carolina University, thanks so much. You're listening to
Enjoy
a 2018 North Carolina pre-election special airing on public radio stations around North Carolina. I'm David Borax here with Jeff Tiberi. We'll be right back.
Good afternoon. It's a midterm election special. Much more with our host, WFAE's David Borax and WUNC's Jeff Tiberi in just a moment. Programming on WFAE is funded this afternoon by our members and Doctors Making House Calls. 105 primary care and specialty clinicians helping complex patients avoid unnecessary ER visits and hospitalizations. Positions available throughout North Carolina. Info at doctorsmakinghousecalls.com. Markdown November 10th, WFAE will be at Lunchbox Records for the WFAE Amplifier Record Sale with a selection of CDs and LPs from WFAE's collection available for purchase. There will also be live performances from some of the musicians featured in our Amplifier podcast, along with food trucks. Get more details and RSVP at WFAE.org.
Is this the most important midterm election of our lifetime, Wayne?
Yes.
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 Absolutely yes.
You're listening to special election coverage. We're live in Charlotte, airing on public radio stations in the Triangle, Asheville, and Wilmington. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jeff Tiberi, across from David Borax. Joining us here in studio now for more analysis is Michael Bitzer, professor of political science at Catawba College. He also runs the website Old North State Politics and is a force on Twitter. Professor, hello. How are you?
I'm well.
The clip you just heard, back up. It was on Charlotte Talks last week. Just size up for me the level of hyperbole in that answer.
Every election is the most critical to Western civilization until the next one. So there you are.
Simple as that.
You asked.
We got into early voting a little bit with Tom Eamon just several moments ago. You do great analysis of the early voting numbers. And initially, this was tracking at a presidential kind of output. We've already seen more early votes in 2018 than we did in the last midterm, 2014. Yep. As a reminder, listeners, we did have a U.S. Senate race then. Give us a sense of where early voting is right now.
We are basically steadying off. I think we're going to end up in between 2014 and 2016. Today's numbers showed a little over 1.5 million votes. That equates to about a quarter of the 7 million registered voters in North Carolina have already voted. So this is a whole new territory. We're in a blue moon election cycle, which means no U.S. Senate race, no governor's race. Right. It's all at the congressional or, you know, statewide constitutional amendments, something like that. This is unheard of.
Yeah, and being not one of these special elections, one of these important elections with top-of-the-ballot races like that, gosh, what a different year for North Carolina. Here in North Carolina, I mean, this is a wave nationwide. Everybody is paying more attention, but what else do you think is going on?
I think it's partly the nationalization of what's going on in North Carolina here as well. I think, you know, Democrats are enthusiastic, and on a scale of 1 to 10, they're at a 12. They're 43% of the early votes so far. If you look at their pool, the voter pool, they're only 38%, so they're overperforming. Republicans are at their numbers in comparison to the voter pool. People are energized and interested in it. Unaffiliateds are below, and that's not surprising. They will either wait to vote on Election Day or they won't show up to vote at all.
There's a reason they've detached from both of these parties, or they've been unaffiliated for a while.
Right.
If enthusiasm is at a 12 for Democrats, it seems as though there is a lot of enthusiasm on the right. We've certainly seen the president in recent days stoking the emotion, the fears, however you want to classify it, as it relates to immigration and this caravan that's moving through Mexico. What's the level of enthusiasm from your eyes on the right?
I think certainly on the right, it is all about the president. I think for Republicans, it's been nationalized. For Democrats, it's all about localism. And I think for Republicans, they tend to have a higher turnout rate in midterms. So they're coming in with one advantage. The other advantage are all these legislative districts that have been gerrymandered to favor them. So what has to happen with the Democratic wave is it has to be big enough to crest over these two advantages that are naturally built into the system for Republicans.
And Jeff, I think you've pointed out that the Republicans came to power in 2010 at a time when those districts were gerrymandered for Democrats, right? Mm-hmm.
They did, right. Yeah. I mean, they drew those. The Democrats had drawn the districts that Republicans won in 2010. Then they redrew them. They cultivated them to their wants and their needs. They have supermajorities. And here we are in 2018. And I mean, to me, it's almost a two-step approach of how many seats can Democrats take back
this year? And then is in 2020, is the legislature really in play? Because then we have another round of redistricting.
Exactly. And we also have what, by all accounts, will be a competitive presidential year. Yeah. So, you know, if we think 2018 is weird and strange, 2020 is going to be off the charts, I think.
Well, we're talking about the legislature and those supermajorities that the Democrats are hoping to break. This all happens in local races, as I said. Yep. What are some of the races that you're watching?
I think the major ones that I'm watching are primarily here in Mecklenburg and also in Wake County. I think the suburban districts. We've heard so much at the national level about the battle is going to be in the suburbs this year. In North Carolina, suburbs tend to be the most Republican of the counties in comparison to urban and certainly rural. But I think the battle is going to be on individual issues and individual districts.
Well, let's talk about one of those. The 41st Senate District here in Mecklenburg County has incumbent Republican Jeff Tart running against Democrat Natasha Marcus. And there, as you mentioned, there are specific issues in those. In this one, it's the I-77 toll lanes, which are being built north of Charlotte. Lots of intense feelings about that.
77 needs to be fixed. And tolls, we know, managed lanes will not fix us, the congestion issue. And that's really the heart and soul. If you want to have people with that can pay a premium to have guaranteed throughput, to make a flight, get to a soccer game, get to a business meeting, so be it. But what we've done is we've ignored the need to provide congestion relief for the residents and the businesses that exist here now.
If you're a private citizen and the most you can do is stand on the bridge and let your voice be heard, that's fine. But when you're the legislator who is in charge of fixing this, it's not okay to just stand on the bridge and posture for the television cameras as if you're against them.
You know, a lot of the attention in this race has been paid to the tolls. I think Marcus has also been talking about things like the Kavanaugh nomination and that sort of thing. But what are your thoughts on this race?
I think this is, you know, we talked about 2016, did I-77 doom Pat McCrory? And I think this is going to be another question, you know, will Jeff Tart be taken down by the I-77 toll roads as well?
So this is one of the many suburban-urban districts. I think Wake and Meck understandably get a lot of attention,
yep.
right? I mean, you've got
yep.
2 million residents between those two yep. counties, roughly 20% of the population. I want to step back a little bit. And so as I look at Wake and Meck, there are a number of incumbents that are certainly in trouble. We'll mm-hmm. see if they're able to defend those seats. I wonder a little bit about this urban-rural divide that we talk about, whether it's right. urban-rural, city-suburban, whatever it is. Depending on what happens next Tuesday, do you think that we could be in a place where there are even fewer voices in the majority party from urban districts across the state?
Oh, I could easily see that. And I think, you know, this trend of the urban-rural divide is growing in intensity. It's growing in intensity nationally, and it's happening here in North Carolina. I think we are truly a mirror image of the nation at times. You know, we tend to be a slight center-right state, but I think as generational shift occurs, as this regionalism occurs, I think we are becoming more and more like the rest of the country.
So everyone that does vote, it already has voted or will vote, will weigh in on a congressional race, will weigh in on his or her House or Senate district. I think it bears mentioning that there were 28 of the districts that the legislature drew back in 2011 that were eventually struck down in federal court for being illegal gerrymanders. They were unconstitutional. And I don't say that to harp on the legislature. I say that more just to note that we have, I mean, from your perspective, there's the factor of incumbency and then there are a factor of open races. We have a lot of districts that people have never totally run in
yeah.
before. What does that entail? What does that,
well,
does that impact
and,
this?
And that's a whole nother dynamic that tends to make things even a little more strange. I mean, an open seat election, candidates may not necessarily know the district, may not know the constituents may not know them as well. And so that is really the prime opportunity for the opposition to pick up that particular district. If you're running with an incumbent, that generally tends to help the incumbent's
right.
party. But this year, incumbency could be a danger in that regard.
I do want to get into money a little bit, if we can. Here in Mecklenburg County, I believe that it will be the most expensive North Carolina House race. We've got a Republican incumbent, Bill Brawley, mm-hmm. challenger Rachel Hunt. She's the daughter of former Governor Jim Hunt. We expect to see more than $1 million in spending on each side. And you're chuckling. I just want to give a couple more examples, then we'll get
yeah.
to it. I know we have some listeners in Wilmington right now, in New Hanover County. Senator Michael Lee, he's being challenged by former Wilmington Mayor Harper Peterson. That Senate race is going to see hundreds and hundreds, if not $1 million, but hundreds of thousands of dollars. Then in Buncombe County, Brian Turner, who's a Democrat in a district that actually slightly leans Republican, right. He's raised $400,000. The money, did you ever think you'd see this kind of money?
Every year we say this has got to be the new record, and then the next election cycle, it tends to break with that as well. Money is certainly critical, but it can only play so much in dynamics that are typically set outside of the district that are influencing things, and the candidates have to respond, and the only way to do it is through money.
All right, we're going to transition in a moment to constitutional amendments, but I do want to ask you about third-party candidates. I don't think that most listeners will remember the name Lon Cecil. I know that you'll remember the name Lon Cecil. He ran for governor 2 years ago. He received more than 100,000 votes,
yeah.
And this was a race that was decided by about 11,000 votes. Had Lon Cecil not been in the race, Pat McCrory may still be the governor of North Carolina. Right. So as we look at 18, is there any Libertarian candidate? I wonder about the 9th Congressional District personally, but are there any third-party candidates who could have an impact?
I think the 9th certainly could. I mean, we've also seen the addition now of two new parties, the Green and the Constitution. Mm-hmm. So as we move forward in North Carolina, it's not just going to be one third-party spoiler. It could be three-party spoilers in that regard.
All right. Well, now we're going to take a look at the six constitutional amendments on the ballot across the state. And these were put onto the ballot by the Republicans in the General Assembly using that supermajority that they have and looking at some issues that they care about. I'm just going to tick them off really quickly. There's the right to hunt and fish. There are changes to the Victims' Rights Amendment. There's a cap on the state income tax at 7%. There's a photo ID requirement that voters are going to be asked to pass judgment on. There's amendments that will give the legislature control of filling judicial vacancies and will give General Assembly party leaders the right to control the Ethics and Elections Board appointments, and it will eliminate nonpartisan representatives on those. So what are people saying about those?
Unfortunately, I've not read up on all of them. I'm familiar with just like a couple with just basic wording. All I know, I come from a family of pretty much all Democrats, so they're all like vote no on all the amendments. But I just also think it's important for me personally to go back and read on them and just see what exactly all entail, just so that I'm aware for myself. I try to vote based on what I know about that issue, about that candidate, whatever. I try not to let the outside noise get to you, but obviously in this climate, it's kind of impossible to do that.
That's Adrian Green of Charlotte, and that is one of the many voters that we have heard from who has weighed in on one or some of these constitutional amendments. They are a very significant and important ballot questions that you've already seen if you've been to your local polling location or will encounter as you head to early voting or head out to vote on Tuesday. I do want to thank Michael Bitzer from Catawba College, professor of political science, who's been chatting with us about the supermajorities and some of the legislative elections. We now are going to transition to these constitutional amendments and chat with Steve Harrison, a politics reporter, political reporter here at WFA. Hey, Steve, how are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Let's start with six. Why are there six constitutional amendments? Seems like a whole lot.
It is a whole lot. And I think I think maybe you can break these six amendments down in two ways. I think there's three that are really important to the Republican General Assembly. Mm-hmm. Two of those deal with shifting power of appointments from the governor to the legislature, and then the other is the photo ID,
yeah,
constitutional amendment.
You've reported on these. We've seen all sorts of opposition. We've seen spending. We've seen the governors come in and together unified against some of the constitutional amendments. What are your biggest takeaways, or what has struck you most about these proposals?
I think with the two amendments that would shift power from the governor to the legislature with judicial appointments and the Board of Elections, I think it's very interesting that the five living governors came out against it. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, Pat McCrory, the former mayor here, he got kind of bent out of shape because he felt like Democratic groups kind of twisted his words, saying that all the former governors wanted to vote against all amendments,
right,
which he did. And he really strongly supports four and is against two. In his words, he felt like no good deed goes unpunished.
Steve Harrison of WFA is here in studio. Rusty Jacobs of WUNC is on the line as well from Chapel Hill. Hey, Rusty, how are you?
Fine. Thanks, Jeff.
Good to chat with you. Glad you're here. So I guess I want to talk a little bit about why lawmakers have taken this approach. I guess I would set it up a little bit by noting that 5 years ago, there was an election bill that was passed that did a number of things. It originally mandated voter ID. It also reduced early voting and eliminated same-day registration. Ultimately, that was struck down in federal court. Lay out for us, Rusty, why that is, part of this story and how some of this, or specifically the voter ID amendment, has ended up on the ballot.
Well, amendments can't be vetoed by the governor. And this is according to the Republican, Republicans who control the legislature, a chance for the voters to weigh in on important issues. The Republicans, too, can point to many polls that do say a majority of North Carolinians in general support the idea of voter ID. Of course, voter ID comes in lots of forms. The form that was that Republicans tried to legislate in that 2013 law was struck down for its effect on, frankly, on what they called targeting African-American communities with surgical precision. But this is putting the general idea of a photo ID requirement to voters. How that will be enforced, that comes later, possibly in a lame duck session after the midterm elections.
Rusty, just a little more background here. How big of a problem has voter fraud been in North Carolina that we're looking at here?
There's a 2016 audit after that election cycle by the State Board of Elections that found, honestly, there were two cases of a possible fraud, and they were instances where family members wanted to vote for a dead relative, I guess to provide some kind of service to a lost loved one. But that's about it. The other cases where there was some improper voting had to do with felons or people unwittingly casting votes when other laws required them not to. But those were not cases where somebody was trying to impersonate another person.
Big picture.
So very,
this
very,
is not...
it's a very low number.
Right. Steve Harrison.
So I was going to say with felons voting, that's a situation where photo ID is not going to make a difference. That's the biggest chunk of kind of the so-called illegal votes. Non-citizens, in theory, it could. In North Carolina, there is fine print on the back of the driver's license that says whether you are that you are not a you can have the license, but you're not a citizen. So, but the biggest chunk of these votes that shouldn't count are felons, and that's not going to change with any kind of photo ID.
Almost surgical precision, that infamous three-word phrase from the federal ruling a couple of years back. There's been significant opposition to some of these six. Steve and or Rusty, we'll start with Steve here in studio. You noted the governors, but where else and whom else and what kind of money are we talking about? There's a lot of opposition.
So one of the most interesting groups is the North Carolina chapter of Americans for Prosperity. That's the group that's founded by the Koch brothers. Mm-hmm. They came out against the against the amendment that would shift the power of filling judicial vacancies solely from the governor, mostly to the legislature. And they felt like it would kind of open the door to cronyism. And they've said they're going to do what they call a six-figure ad buy to try and defeat it.
And we have seen millions of dollars in there's a campaign called Deceitful Amendments. I think that the number we got yesterday was something like $7.9 million that they had raised. Rusty, what has struck you about the opposition or the support for these? What stands out?
I want to go back to something
Sure. You
brought up. I mean, we talked about how the Republicans couldn't get a voter ID law past the courts. They've had trouble with at least one of the amendments that is on this fall's ballot, right? If you think about
Absolutely.
The original legislation for transferring appointment power from the governor to the legislature over the Board of Elections, that was a much, much broader measure. That covered countless boards and commissions that were created by the General Assembly. That got scaled back. That was certainly a case of legislative overreach as far as the courts are concerned. So these amendments are a chance for the Republican leadership, hope in their minds, possibly to get past courts that haven't found in their favor.
Rusty, hold that thought. You're listening to a midterm election special on public radios across North Carolina. We need to take a break. We'll be right back with more about the North Carolina elections and the amendments. I'm David Borax with Jeff Tiberi.
Thank you.
And stay tuned. More of our midterm election specials still ahead. I'm Tina Simmons. Thank you for joining us at 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source. And you can stream us at WFAE.org. After you cast your ballot in the midterms on Tuesday, be sure to join WFAE staff and listeners for a midterm elections results party at Divine Barrel Brewing. Doors will open at 6:30. Find out more details at WFAE.org. Our programming is made possible in part today by WFAE members and Atrium Health, serving the Carolinas in specialties like heart, cancer, and pediatric care. Atrium Health, dedicated to promoting better lives through better health.
Coverage airing. Welcome back. This is special coverage airing on public radio stations across North Carolina. We're previewing the midterm elections, which, of course, with early voting, are already underway. We're expecting those results to come in on Tuesday. I'm Jeff Tiberi of WUNC.
And I'm David Borax from WFAE. We're going to continue our discussion about these half-dozen proposals to amend the state constitution. Wake Forest University political science professor John Dinan joins us from Winston-Salem. Hello, John.
Hello.
And political reporter Rusty Jacobs is on the line from WUNC Studios in Chapel Hill. And my colleague Steve Harrison is here in the studio with us as well.
Now, before we get to a little bit more of the conversation, we'd like to hear from a few voices on these constitutional amendments. Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville helped us gather this collection of voices.
I just wanted to know, like, how you could reconcile the positions of being for small government, but at the same time being for an expansive local government program that violates the human rights of prisoners and expands the required spending of municipalities significantly to even enforce it in any remotely meaningful way.
We are not going to be a state that's going to overtax you, and we are so committed to that that we've actually put in the Constitution limits on, in this case, the income tax rate.
What the legislature is pushing here is a cap on income tax, which is collected by the state of North Carolina. And to me, what that could potentially mean is if there's a cap on income tax and the state has a need to raise revenue, they may further pull revenue from sales taxes.
I think the Constitution is sacred. And when I asked in committee, what will this amendment do and what are the impediments to hunting and fishing in North Carolina, I never got a straight answer.
I'm not an attorney and I'm not a law expert, but to me, in just my experience over the years, it seems like it's a little bit easier to get a law overturned than it is a constitutional amendment.
We've done a really good job in our society of providing defendants' rights and protecting them with the Constitution and ensuring that they were provided those rights. But we need victims' rights on parity with the defendant's rights.
I come to the one about victims' rights. Victims' rights, well, if that seems right, I think I should vote yes on that one. And it just so happens that there was a lady in the booth next to me that I knew. And I said, hey, what's about this? And she explained to me that victims' rights, they'll give that to fetus and they'll use it to make abortion illegal. So, okay.
Those are the voices of some local officials here in North Carolina, also a few voters you just heard from, weighing in on these six proposals to amend the state constitution. John Dinan, politics and international affairs professor at Wake Forest University, joins us now. Professor, before we go big picture, and you've done a lot of research on state constitutional issues, but before we go big picture, I want to just ask you about that last soundbite, that last snippet we heard there, as it pertains to this Victims' Rights Amendment. It's also known as Marcy's Law. Similar amendments are on the ballot in a number of states. We've heard some concern from folks on the left that this could be used as a way to, down the road, alter abortion rules or regulations in the state. What's your read on that?
Sure, and I have seen that be mentioned in North Carolina. I would say that's probably among the least likely outcomes of such an amendment. We've seen Marcy's Law Victims' Rights Amendments pass in six states, It's on the ballot in five other states, and that has not been an issue that's come up in other states, and it's highly unlikely that that would be an outcome. One never says never, but among the reasons for opposing the Victims' Rights Amendment, that would not be in the top 10.
Okay. So that's...
And Jeff...
Go ahead, Rusty.
I just, you know, I wanted to talk about that one, too. You know... The efforts in the legislature, in the North Carolina legislature, to pass a Marcy's Law type bill predate this amendment, this election cycle. And there's actually been pretty broad bipartisan support. Frankly, I don't think you hear the kind of fervent opposition to that amendment that you'd hear from Democrats and other opponents of the Republican-controlled legislature with other amendments. When it comes to this one, there's been broad bipartisan support predating this particular fight. I mean, I think even supporters of Marcy's Law might say, look, we don't need an amendment to do it. And actually, there already is an amendment in the state constitution for victims' rights. This would just expand those rights. So you know, I agree with the professor that is, I think that's probably a view on an extreme side of the spectrum.
John, I want to talk about the campaigns for and against these amendments. You know, what we have right now, instead of looking at these individually, we have the two parties telling their partisans to vote one way or the other on them. In fact, there are no numbers on these, which is one of our listeners asked us the other day, why are there no numbers on these amendments, which might make it easier to talk to voters about them?
Yeah, it is unusual not to have numbers. That's part of the elections rules that were passed by the legislature. They said they should be put on the ballot in an unnumbered fashion. But one thing that we'd say is just looking at other states, and there's 99 constitutional amendments on the ballot across the country this year in a total of 29 states. So North Carolina, six amendments make up some of those 99. And what you do see is that voters are able to make distinctions among amendments. That is, sometimes you'll see states and they'll see six amendments put out there. Florida has 12 amendments on the ballot this year. Colorado has nine. It's not at all a surprise to see voters approve of some of those and disapprove of others. So even though the two main parties have taken an all-or-nothing approach, it would not at all be a surprise, judging from past experience, for voters to actually pick and choose and decide among them, not in a all-or-nothing approach.
Steve, this is a multi-step process. Questions are on the ballot now. We can get projections from you all or predictions if you want to make them. But I would note that since the current state constitution has been ratified, I believe it's 37 out of 45 proposed amendments have been approved by the voters, which is to say there's a good chance some or most, perhaps all of these, will be approved come next Tuesday. Then the next step is the language needs to be written and there would need to be implementing language. Take us a little bit through that next step. What does that entail and what hurdles might emerge?
So let's talk about the photo ID.
Please.
Polls suggest it has a good chance of passing. So let's say it does. Then there's this implementation language. And the legislature would kind of could go two routes. They can go what's called a strict photo ID law, which would be things like driver's license, passport, military ID. Mm-hmm. Other states have this kind of broader photo ID law, like you could use your debit card if it has a picture on it, a neighborhood association ID. So that will be a huge fight if this passes. That will take place at the legislature. And then, you know, there would probably be a legal fight afterwards or kind of concurrently to the amendment.
The implementing language and the voter ID, I think you and I are on the same page and just kind of forecasting the most controversy there. As it pertains to the other five, if any of those were to go forward, what do you see as the most or the least controversial?
I would assume hunting and fishing and Marcy's Law would be the least controversial and the least fights. I think with hunting and fishing, I think it's interesting. You know, we're talking earlier about both sides, you know, one side saying vote for all six, another side saying vote against all six. And I think hunting and fishing, there's just been an idea, well, maybe this is going to attract rural voters to the polls. I'm not sure if that's going to happen, but I think it does make the messaging a little bit hard on the left when you have to explain, well, vote against all six, this isn't that bad, but I think the moment you have to start kind of clarifying your position, people stop listening. They get confused.
Well, one of these amendments, as we mentioned, is to put a cap on the
To lower the cap. Currently 10%. This would bring it down to 7%.
State income tax at 7%. Yep. I think there have been concerns in some areas. I think the mayor of Asheville has expressed some concern about what effect this would have on cities. What are those concerns? Any of you jump in here?
Go ahead, Rusty.
Go ahead. Well, I was just going to we heard one excerpt from an interview, a concern that binding the hands of government in an economic downturn, the government needs needs solutions and ways and measures to raise revenue. And if there's a cap on the tax, and again, let's emphasize, this is not a tax cut. I think some of the polls have shown people are actually confused at what they're voting on. It would lower the current ceiling of 10% to 7%. But the income tax in the state right now is well below that, and it's scheduled to go down to 5.25% in 2019. What happens, though, in an economic downturn, if you can't raise the income tax past a certain point? Do you go after sales tax or property taxes? And who bears the brunt of it? Are we talking about something that's going to fall harder on working class or middle class people?
And I think I was just going to say that, right, if in this scenario of an economic downturn where the state, they can't raise any more revenue with the income tax, you could have a situation where counties and cities have to kind of pick up the difference. They really only have one main source of revenue, which is the property tax.
And John Dinan, did you have a thought on this?
Well, I was just going to say here we can talk about the origin of how it came to be reducing it to 7%. Originally, when this was in the legislature, it was going to have a 5.5% cap. And in that sense, that was going to be right where the income tax is right now, slated to go down to 5.25%. So that would have left very little room for flexibility. But as a result of some negotiations between the House and the Senate, it was eventually put on the ballot at 7%. So there is some flexibility there, and the question is whether there's enough flexibility there to take account of any projects that have kind of come up over the years or from any economic downturn.
Professor, I want to direct this question toward you, but really, Steve or Rusty, if you guys want to add to it, please do. As we think about why these are on the ballots, there's obviously the court issue. Provisions or efforts were struck down in court, so they've kind of circumvented that, and they've put things on the ballot. We've heard about hunting and fishing constitutional amendment could drive voter turnout. I do think another arm to this is potentially daring Democrats to vote against something so that the Republicans can then use it as a wedge issue or an attack issue in the campaigns. Professor, has this been a winning issue for any particular Republicans across the state?
Well, it is interesting when people have often said, will this boost turnout and therefore have spillover effects in other races? That was where the discussion was in the summer. I always said, well, that may be an effect of it, but I'd be much more likely to look for an effect on how does this inject these issues into the campaigns in a way that people running for state House or state Senate are forced to respond to questions about that. It just changes the agenda of the debate. And I've seen that come up in several campaigns where they'll be trying to tie a Republican, a legislator will try to tie a Democratic candidate to the voter ID issue and say, oh, vote against this person. Why so-and-so does not support the voter ID amendment? And so you'll see this come up in various ways. Probably both parties could be using that. But it does have that. And that would be the more dominant effect that I would see, aside from boosting turnout, which may or may not be the case at the margins. But it does make that a topic of the campaign. Newspapers are asking about these. These are being asked in forums. And so it does force the candidates to take a stand on them.
As we've talked about, a couple of these amendments would shift power away from the governor and towards the General Assembly. One of those is the one that would give General Assembly party leaders the right to control the appointments to the Ethics and Elections Boards, and it also eliminates nonpartisan representation on that. The issues there are kind of complicated. Rusty, what do we know about the background behind that one and what we're looking at there?
And let me start by saying one thing, because I've spoken to people and they're very adamant. It's actually what it's eliminating is any representation of one of the major parties. It's not total nonpartisan representation. You're right. The current board has one position that is, it's not necessarily, it doesn't have to be unaffiliated. It could be somebody from the Constitution or the Libertarian Party.
There you go. The ballot language has been confusing and we've been tripped up here, but...
That's right.
That.
But
And now I've forgotten your question, Steve.
Your thoughts on this this particular amendment that's on the Constitution, to which would basically give the General Assembly control over the Ethics and Elections Board.
Right. I mean, again, you see the five living ex-governors all banding together to oppose this. This has been an issue really from the moment Roy Cooper was declared the winner in his contest with Pat McCrory. Legislature has been trying to take control of this body, and even though their initial legislation was ruled unconstitutional, they are determined to keep heading at it. And again, they want to try to do it via amendment because it hasn't worked for them in the courts.
Okay. We actually have a question off of Facebook here. I don't know if any of you have this answer at your fingertips, but listener Christina wants to know, why would Marcy's Law cost $11 million? What are the extra costs there?
Well, I'll answer that, because we have seen six other states pass Marcy's Law amendments, which are the strengthening of existing victims' rights amendments, which North Carolina already has, dating back to a 1996 amendment. And what we've seen is that it will require prosecutors' offices to do even more than they're doing now, to actually make notifications of victims or their families, to provide them information about the status of defendants. And so to get a precise, there's been varying claims about exactly how much will be. Is it more $10 or $11 million or $30 million? But it likely will cost some extra money for prosecutors' offices to do the notification and providing information.
And let's talk a little bit now about the laws here, that the amendments that would have to be implemented by the legislature. I think in particular the voter ID law, we've talked a little bit about that. But do we know what we're voting on, and what do we think is going to happen there?
I mean, I'll take up there's several of these that actually will require state legislation to actually put them into being. We've already mentioned that about the voter ID law. We're not sure which actually IDs will be required, which exceptions will be granted. The amendment says exceptions should be granted. That all has to be worked out. Other matters, for instance, the judicial vacancies amendment directs the legislature to set up a merit selection commission, but there still is the precise legislation of setting up that commission. The amendment sets out guidelines about it shall be made up of appointees from the following persons, but there is work to be done to actually figure out what that merit selection commission would be, and the role of that merit selection commission would be to identify names, to forward them to the General Assembly. The General Assembly would then forward two of those names to the governor in the case of midterm judicial vacancies. Those are just some of the ways in which the legislature will, if any of these amendments are approved, several of them will require the legislature to come back and actually pass implementing legislation.
Sorry, go ahead, Steve.
I was just going to say, I think with the commission for the appointments, I think that the language talks about some are going to be from the legislature, some from the governor's office, but it doesn't say how many spots each one gets. So that would be another fight moving forward.
In the final couple of moments, I'd love to hear from each of you. We can just pinwheel this. There's been a lot of money opposing all of these. There's been a lot of money supporting some of them. We've seen some polling. I think Spectrum News had a poll out yesterday that the executive power constitutional amendment proposals, the support for those seems to be diminishing. What is your gut? What is the little bit of a polling we have tell you about where you think these six are going to end up come Wednesday morning? Professor, where would your money be?
Sure. Well, first of all, we've never seen a Victims' Rights Amendment or a Hunting and Fishing Amendment go down to defeat. We've had 34 Victims' Rights Amendments, 6 Marcy's Law Amendments. There's been 20 Hunting and Fishing Rights Amendments the last 2 decades. If North Carolina voters defeat either of those, that's historic news across the country. Voter ID laws have had mixed effects. Amendments have had mixed effects. Minnesota voters actually turned down a voter ID amendment. Now, then Mississippi and Missouri voters have approved them. And so that more often than not, those are approved. Tax amendments have had mixed grounds. Georgia passed a somewhat similar amendment 4 years ago. They said the income tax rate can't go above 6%. On the other hand, some more aggressive amendments have gone down to defeat. We do not have much to go on in terms of the institutional power amendments, the judicial vacancy amendment, and the ethics and election board amendments. Those we'll know on election day.
We'll leave it there. Professor John Dinan of Wake Forest University, Steve Harrison of WFE, and Rusty Jacobs joining us from Chapel Hill of WUNC. Thank you all so much.
And thanks for listening to this pre-election special. We'll be back tomorrow at 3 p.m. on WFAE, WUNC, WHQR in Wilmington, and Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville, and at 7 p.m. on WFDD in Winston-Salem. We'll focus on the congressional and Supreme Court races and also discuss gerrymandering. We want to thank Blue Ridge Public Radio for its contributions to today's programs. And our producers today are WUNC's Elizabeth Friend and WFAE's Tina Simmons and Greg Collard. You can listen to this program on the websites of WFAE, WUNC, Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville, and WHQR in Wilmington, and WFDD in Winston-Salem. And you can watch it on Facebook. I'm David Borax.
And I'm Jeff Tiberi. Thanks for listening.
And you've been listening to a midterm election special here at 90.7 WFAE Charlotte and 90.3 WFHE Hickory, Charlotte's NPR news source. After casting your ballot on Tuesday, join us for an elections results party at Divine Barrel Brewing. Find out more details at WFAE.org. We'll catch you up on the day in news with All Things Considered coming up next on WFAE. Programming's funded in part today by our members and Bradley, a full-service law firm, helping clients navigate the complexities of today's technological advances and constantly evolving data privacy laws. Details at Bradley.com.